episode 29 of the ReWrap Podcast, where we talk all things photo, video, and the creative lifestyle. This week, I got Jaren Schneider of Resource Mag Online. He's the editor-in-chief, and he's no longer in Manhattan. He's back on the West Coast. Welcome back, Jaren.
And I'm Karaman Nagumin, portrait and headshot photographer.
And then we also have special guest this week, Julio Shorio out of Austin, Texas. He's a Panasonic luminary and a professional portrait and commercial photographer who single-handedly put cinematographs on the map.
Howdy.
He did. That's really true. All right, guys. Yeah. So, you know, Jaren, how we always talk about, like, what are the top three things Resource Podcast talks about or ReWrap Podcast talks about? Drones, Canon, and Sony. And so let's start with drones, your favorite.
Yeah.
Go ahead and lead us into this first story.
DJI announced that they are adding some autopilot features to their popular Phantom series, as well as the Inspire 1. And I noticed actually on this article, I noticed that Julio commented here that it was likely in response to 3DR. And 3DR as a company is actually in response to DJI, which is interesting to me and it's on its own. But I was kind of thinking it was going to be more of in response to stuff like the Lily flying camera and like the Hexo thing, which are all very focused on making it easy for general consumers to drone. But I didn't know 3DR was doing that, but I'm not actually surprised because they needed something to differentiate themselves, right?
Well, 3DR has been doing it for a while with the Pixhawk. I mean, I have the Iris Plus, which is an older version, and I have all that technology in this drone that's been around for quite some time. So, you know, the guys in Austin, a lot of them came over from DJI when DJI laid off their Austin team. And so 3DR took them in, and then their what they created was the Solo, which is pretty badass.
Yeah, I've heard that. I actually thought, I don't know who told me this, but 3DR was actually founded by one of the co-founders of DJI or something like that, where they just had a falling out and he made his own company.
No, 3DR was founded by a hobbyist from Tijuana and by the editor of Wired, Chris Anderson.
Really?
So they got together because they were big drone heads, and they started 3DR. Now Colin Gwynn, he was one of the he's like a celebrity in the drone world. He came over from DJI in Austin.
Okay, so I must have heard was like that whole Austin thing is where all those guys came from.
Yeah, there was there's a lot of and I can say this because I don't work for either company, so. If anyone gets pissed off, the hell with you. But, DJI was really not feeling the success that Colin was getting and his team in Austin, because they were putting the Phantom on a map, not DJI. And so there was like bruised egos coming out of China. And basically they were just like, see you later, to the team. And then it seems like, cool, teams like we're going to get our revenge, so to speak. Not that they said that, but surely after DJI let them go, and then here comes NAB 3DR out of nowhere with this badass drone that's designed for photographers and filmmakers.
Yeah.
And if you've not flown a Solo, it is like it's like playing a video game. It is so, so easy. If you've seen the launch video where they had the baboons flying the Solos,
yeah.
I mean, that's like somewhat staged and somewhat not staged, as far as them picking up the controller and messing with it. That's like, so it's like if a baboon could fly the Solo.
Yeah. That means I can do it. Cause
anybody can do it, man.
I'm slightly smarter than a baboon. Their booth at NAB was dope. So, that's cool that, they'd had it first. It'd be interesting to see which autopilot is going to be better. Based on how long 3DR has been doing it, I would imagine maybe theirs is going to be better, but it's at least I like competition. I don't care where it comes from. I've always a huge fan of it. So more competition, the better. So I like that DJI is finally adding these features
in. You guys say autopilot. I'm not a drone person or a drone head. So explain to me like I'm five.
You want me to go?
Go do it.
Okay. So I don't know how it works with the DJI device, but with the Solo, you're using your iPhone or iPad or your Android device, the screen as a controller. You basically can set up a flying slider called a cable cam. So the cable cam, so you basically frame up the shot. So so it looks perfect, point A, and you store that. And then you frame it up. So you fly to point B and you frame that up and you say, okay, great, this is point B. And then you hit go. And then the solo will smoothly move from point A to point B. And while it's doing that, your controller controls the entire camera. So it's like it working in tandem with the computers to make this amazingly smooth shot. And that's cable cam. And then there's orbit. So orbit will make a circle around whatever building you want. And then there's a follow me. So follow me, like if you're on a mountain bike or you're hiking, the solo will follow you as you're doing whatever. And then there's a selfie mode. And there's all these cool program modes that are built in for getting these badass shots without having to spend years learning it.
So based on that, DJI's is called Waypoints. Point of interest, which is the one that circles you and follow me. So right. They copied them directly. You even described them in the order that I have them here from the DJI thing.
That totally was not staged either. So.
And we saw a lot of these features for me for the first time. I saw them on the Lily camera when we did that video.
Yeah. Still, I think the Lily is not even, it doesn't even compete with either of these two because it's a completely different market.
Yeah, it's
that
like
would
consumer.
Is it even out consumer. Yet?
No, it'll be out in January. Exactly. It doesn't even compete yet. The concept doesn't even compete, I don't think.
That's the thing. There's so many concepts with drones, like the one that's a watch and you throw it. And I mean, it's one thing to make like a Kickstarter video. It's another thing to actually produce
a shipping product.
A flying robot. Okay. It's a flying freaking robot with a camera that's smooth and steady. You know, trying to get that to market and all the amazing amount of technology and engineering that goes into it. There's only so many people in the world that are good with autopilot technology. And a majority of those people work at 3DR. So I don't know where these other people are coming from to make the Lily. And then there's that 6.1,
It's called the Hexo. The Hexo. The Hexo. The six bladed one. Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know where they're coming from, but there's going to be a lot of catching up, but it's good for everybody because it's just going to, put the tools closer to reach.
I will say, I know that it is complicated to make them. The inside, they showed us the guts of the demo Lily that they had, and that thing was a rat's nest in there because they hadn't finished building it yet. But it worked, so and they didn't have to manually control it; like it was being controlled by all the stuff they built into it. So, I mean, you're probably right. I mean, it's going to be really complicated for them to make it not a rat's nest in there and also make like 1,000 of them at a time. But, I like to think that they could do it. We'll see. But you're right. They're not out yet. And they still have several months before people start to wonder, hey, where's the Lily camera?
Well, then there's other things, too, like that are not in the, that are not in the control of the manufacturers, like satellites. You know, you got to connect to a certain amount of satellites to get a decent signal. Those satellites are gone because of cloud coverage, or if you're indoors, then what do you do?
Right.
There's modules for the solo you plug in that's like an optical flow sensor. And so you set it for like 30 feet. Anything that comes underneath the device, the solo, it'll rise up to 30 feet above that.
Does it have any way to avoid stuff in its way, or is that?
That's being worked on.
Yeah. So, not right now. Nobody has that right now, as far as I understand it. It's way too complicated for most people to handle. That'd be really awesome if 3DR came out with that first and it worked really well. That'd be dope.
Well, they're working with the government so that, say, around airports and other sensitive areas, there'll be geofences set up.
Nice.
So that way some doofus doesn't end up flying into a White House or, I don't know, an airplane taking off. Like, you see this
someone
all the time.
Someone will figure out how. I promise you, someone will figure out how to be a doofus and do it.
Yes, for sure.
All right, since you were complaining that we talk about drones constantly, let's stop talking about drones and talk about Canon instead. Yeah. The other things that we talk about
too
much.
Yeah, we talk about a lot. Canons. All right, so, this press release came out, to us it was last night, which is Sunday night in Labor Day weekend, I guess from Japan, that Canon's putting out a 250-megapixel APS-H sensor, which is 1.3 crop, by the way, 250 megapixels. And the last quote of their, I posted in our Facebook group what they intended it to be for. So
yeah, not for photographers. No. It's like for security purposes and stuff like that.
It's
military.
It's the real life. Someone made a comment in our little chat room saying it's a real life enhance button.
Yeah. like this forensic thing from CSI.
Yes.
Hans, yes. From the movie Taken, where he takes that cell phone picture and goes into like that public little camera thing and hits Enhance and it gets good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then like, oh, there's a reflection in the window. Enhance on that. Oh, look, there's a license plate. Enhance on that.
This, along with that 40 or that 4 million ISO or whatever camera that also wasn't the sensor Canon announced that was also not meant for anything other mm-hmm. than security or whatever, I'm not going to get excited about these. They're not something we're going to see in like a DSLR or a non-DSLR or a camera of any sort for the consumer market or pro market anytime soon.
This is Canon's quote. Canon is considering the application of this technology in specialized surveillance and crime prevention tools, ultra-high resolution measuring instruments, and other industrial equipment, and the field of visual expression. Now, I'm going to give a bit of expression here. I don't want to edit a 250 megapixel photo on my
It's 19,580 by 12,600 pixels.
Yeah, no, I'm not doing that.
Julio's shaking his head over there. The thing is with these things, if you look at the 5DS, basically anyone who shot with that, yes, the picture is bigger, but the quality of the picture hasn't improved. So it's just a larger version of what you get in like a 5D Mark III. So it's already like, I don't care. If you're going to make it bigger, in my opinion, I think it should be made better. And this isn't doing that. I doubt it. And who cares? They're not even aiming to.
Yeah. Everybody from Canon that's still hanging on, they're like, we want a mirrorless camera. And like, how about a 250 megapixel sensor? We want a mirrorless camera. How about the EOS M? We want a mirrorless camera. You know, how about 14 million ISO? And it's like,
none of these things, you said, that's, which is funny. How about a mirrorless camera? How about the EOS M? How about a mirrorless camera? Like, repeat the question again as if they didn't hear it.
How about not a piece of crap, you know?
You guys, I love you guys. You're so harsh. But then they decided that, we're already shipping a mirrorless camera in Europe and Asia. Let's just go ahead and flip it on over. Yeah, because, you know, most people, you look up the EOS M 3 and people already have reviews on it and they're still waiting for a proper better camera.
You're not gonna get it.
Canon's got the most to lose, so they're gonna be moving slowly.
Yeah, exactly.
And Nikon too.
People are still buying.
All out.
Who?
Canon and Nikon are still making these cameras, like the DSLR, the big clunkers, because people still buy them.
Right,
because
people don't know any better.
Yeah.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't know any better, I gotta say.
Right. They keep looking at people who they idolize or they want to shoot like, maybe. Or it looks more professional, quote unquote. So they keep buying that. But I think eventually that's going to change. It's already changing right now.
Yeah. As soon as people stop selling their cameras and try selling their art, they'll realize that maybe they don't need to carry all that gear because I'm selling the art.
Yeah, this is true.
That's true. But I got this lens. It's like, you know, the size of my leg, you know.
Exactly.
Don't you want to hire me now? It's like, well, my uncle just bought the Mark II version of that leg size lens, so no.
My uncle.
Yeah. And my aunt just bought a sous vide, so we're having a 5-star dinner tonight. All right. Speaking of mirrorless, though, and this is big news. We've been waiting for this for a long time. The official announcement of Vlog L for the GH4. It's a $99 upgrade. I guess, Julio, I know it's not a product, but I guess we can buy it via Panasonic's website, via
dealers.
Dealers. Yeah. And then I guess it's a little complicated because what do you do? It's a new firmware and you export this firmware onto an SD card, like a little activation. I don't know.
Just think of Vlog as an app. It's an app that you're buying that is going to give you not all the dynamic range of a Vericam, but very close. And if anyone doesn't know what a Vericam is, look it up. They're about $35,000.
The Vericam S35.
Yeah, so for $100, you're taking a GH4, and you're going to be able to get an image quality, or I should say flexibility-wise, very similar to a Vericam.
Yeah, and you know, most people who, I'm not really sure what Vlog, what it is or what log is. It's a logarithmic. Is it a codec? Yeah, it's a codec.
It's not a codec. It's more like a photo style. It's just it's a super flat type of video. Now people want raw video and a DSLR sized camera like a GH4. But I mean, what do we need raw anything for? It's because we want to be able to take that flat image in post and be able to have some flexibility in the headroom and of course in the shadows as well. And that's what Vlog gives you. So without having to use raw video where it would take up a tremendous amount of space, you still get a lot of detail in the highlights and the shadows with your video. So that's really where the Vlog comes in handy. And it is for truly for working pros. It's not something that an enthusiast would get. And of course, those are the people that are all upset about it is the enthusiast. I got to pay $100.
Yeah. I think though, anyone who has to say or whine that they have to pay $100, this is not for you. It, easily.
No. You wouldn't, you'd have no reason to use it.
No. No, the same people that cry over like paying for Creative Cloud every month are crying over $100 purchase. And if you have a business, $100 yeah. purchase, you know, what's that? It's nothing. Yeah. You know?
I spend more on a meal for two than I would on that.
That's because you eat good, Jaron. That's because you eat really good.
So one thing I did want to mention also as after speaking to Panasonic, I guess I could have spoken to you, Julia, if I had known we were going to talk, but I asked them why in Europe the GH4R was the only option. You can't actually just buy a firmware update. You can have to buy a brand new camera.
Did not know this.
And it's they told me that it has Vlog L installed and also has no recording limit from the previous version, mm-hmm. which was 30 minutes. I think maybe 29.30 minutes, but it's not there anymore. So, and then the US gets the Vlog update through version 2.3 firmware and activation, and that's the difference. So if you're in Europe, you don't get the $99 upgrade, unfortunately, as far as I understand it.
I believe that is correct. Yep.
That sucks. Does this mean that those people are just... Because I know it's like, what, import laws or... I guess laws in that country that prevent this from happening. It's not Panasonic's choice. It's just, I guess, the hand is forced. And so, I guess the only people... I don't know. I don't know if there's a solution for those guys, but that kind of sucks for them. I'm excited
you can't please everybody, man. There has to be some decisions made at some point. Otherwise, nothing gets done, you know?
And let's look at this from this perspective. The GH4 is dirt cheap. Like, it's
down to $13.99 retail.
Yeah.
Right,
like,
now.
There's, like, who cares? Just get it. And if you're bothered by it, I know Julio can't tell me anything, but I'm expecting a GH5 at NAB next year. So if you really can't fathom buying a new GH4,
he's giving us the maybe.
Maybe.
Well, no, I'll tell you straight up. I've not heard anything about a GH5, and I work directly with the engineers, so I'm like, what's going on with the GH5? They're like, long ways away, because their thing is Panasonic learned from the GH2 that that so much can be squeezed out of it, so they're basically hacking their own camera.
And Panasonic hired, I believe his name is Vitaly, the hacker who did all the firmware hacking for the GH1, I think the GH2, and I guess GH3 before they picked him up.
Oh, that's cool.
That's what I understand, because he stopped making that stuff and just as a hack, and it's now just built into the GH4. That's what.
that's funny.
I guess that's what I understand. A lot of the GH2 stuff, like the hacks he built in, came into the GH3, which was basically higher bitrate video, which we didn't get in GH2. But that's just a little, side talk, stuff like that. That's good. I'm excited. You two both have GH4s. I'm trying to get my hands on one. And I'm actually very excited about this. I've never graded anything in my life. I just hope that I can get...
Oh, it's super easy now. Thanks. Okay, I'm going
to
plug
Adobe. No, talk to me. Yeah, talk.
Yeah, thanks to the new Premiere. Yeah.
Yeah, the new Lumetri color panel makes it so flippin' easy. Yeah, it's like fun. Good. I hated color grading up until like the beginning of this year. And now it's like, that's my favorite part. I get to go and I get to play with the colors. And it's so easy. It's like basically editing a raw photo. It's so fun.
That's what I was hoping for. Because I always
Vlog is amazing when you start using it.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm excited.
That's what I'm looking forward to. I got to install that. Still haven't bought it yet. I've been in New York for the past couple of weeks. I haven't used my GH4, and I'm shooting tomorrow too. So,
All right.
Okay, it's so this killer, man. It's I got to say, I've been working on making looks for Vlog L for some time. So I'm gonna probably have something to offer with my own LUTs, because I think that I would love to see Lightroom use LUTs at some point.
By the way, guys, LUTs, LUTS, look up tables used for, I guess they're photo styles or video styles, I suppose, for log footage.
That wasn't the original purpose of a LUT, as far as I understand it, but it's what they're used for now.
Yes.
I think so. I don't know.
I can't remember the original purpose.
Purpose of like what a log was for, I did some research. It was Kodak had made this device and that was scanned in your film footage, like not you, but like Hollywood's film footage. So it was like super legit, super expensive. And the way they were able to like obviously pull out the most detail using this kind of algorithm or picture style, really. And then people wanted to be able to get back to the original look of the film. And so this is where lookup tables came from. And so from what I understand, a direct lineage from that, I guess it's called Cineon. Kodak Cineon is what Panasonic has been using in their like super pro cameras. And even you mentioned the Vericam S35 using just Vlog, right? Mm-hmm. And then Vlog L has shown up in the Panasonic DVX200 camcorder. Mm-hmm. And now we have Vlog L in the GH4. Right. And so any of those lookup tables, those LUTs that applied to any Cineon type of grade or type of log will work on those. Basically, Cineon LUTs will work on GH4 right now and look great.
Yeah, anything that'll work with like the Alexa, I think it's the Rec 709, right? Mm-hmm. The basic profile that's built into Premiere, so that'll get you back to your baseline color. But it's really like the roll off from highlights to shadows is so smooth with Vlog L. Once you get into grading, it's just fantastic. I love it.
Okay, guys, so let's move away from specs, right? Because our next story is about specs versus fun. And I'm not talking about glasses versus people who don't wear glasses, because I wear glasses.
That's a dad joke.
Yeah.
Dad joke.
And Julio's still catching up.
I totally wasn't paying attention. I was. I put you guys on mute. I cleared my throat, and I was like, wait, it's actually recording that. Okay, so
that's okay. I'll take that out. But okay, so Julia, we're talking specs versus fun. Mm-hmm. And just an example from actually FujiRumors.com. This is not a rumor. This is just that just happened to be posted there. Mm-hmm. Where they made a great point about how Sony A7 R2, great camera, great specs, but not a lot of fun compared to they were comparing to, let's say, the Fuji X-T1 and the Fuji X100T as well. But what do you guys feel about that? Yeah, like on paper, the Sony A7 R2 looks king of the hill. I think, God, we talk about the Sony every week. I'm sick of the Sony. I'll be honest. But on paper, it looks like it's king of the hill. But in actual use, having a fun camera, having a camera that kind of helps you and, I don't know, motivates you, inspires you to shoot more with it, is a better camera. It's a more fun camera. What do you guys think?
I have not shot with the Fuji before, I'm going to be completely honest.
Okay.
But I would agree that shooting with the Sony wasn't fun.
Ooh.
Have you shot with it yet, Julio?
I shot with Fuji's the X-Pro 1 for like mm-hmm. 3 months. This was before I was a luminary and was kind of exploring where to go with my system, and I did not like it at all. And then I shot.
You're not alone there. It's I think the X-T1 is the one that everyone's really in love with.
It's a cool camera.
Yeah.
And it looks, I think the Fujis look really nice. The way they look, but I don't care if it looks really good and I can't get anything in focus. I know they kind of got that fixed now, but you know,
I'll do a counterpoint because I did shoot with the X-Pro 1 for a behind-the-scenes shoot, and it was someone else's camera, and it was definitely after firmware updates. And I'm used to shooting with like my rangefinder Leica, and so shooting the X-Pro 1, it was nice. It's unique to have autofocus. That was something new that I was not used to, mm-hmm. And it was nice. It wasn't as nice as mine. My Leica, of course, you know, price difference aside and what you're just used to, but it was more fun than I had been given. Somebody handed me, I think, like a 7D, this is Mark I, when I was second shooting a wedding. They wanted me to shoot Canon, so I'm like, all right, let me grab that. And that was a struggle for me, or at least that was more, I guess I just didn't have as fun with, like, say, a bigger camera than I did with the smaller X-Pro 1 after firmware updates. And or even after, I mean, that's why I shoot Leica already, because it just inspires me. It pushes me to like make more work. I like using it. I think that's the bottom line. So I think the story, the whole theme is that, okay, you have this technically superior camera, but it just kind of blah. It's kind of cold. It's kind of methodical.
Well, yeah.
I would agree with that sentiment about it being cold and methodical. Now it takes amazing photo. I think when I was really like jiving with it was mm-hmm. when I was shooting some landscapes, and they were coming out, like the colors were just so good. So I was like, ah, oh, yeah, I was like really getting into it. But when I look at my other photos that I took with it, stuff indoors, stuff in studio, I just finished today shooting a little bit with the new Tamron 35 and on 5D Mark III. And that was one of those feelings where I was like, oh man, I'm loving this. Like, I was flowing. And there aren't a lot of feelings that I can say I was doing that when I had the Sony. Now, the Sony makes great stuff. So, like, when I'm shooting video and when I'm working, I don't need to be going, yeah, every time. Like, I can usually get my footage and then get out. That's the way I work. But I can see where some people are coming from here. I just think it's a funny argument at all that this conversation is like, you know, the maybe, and even comparing the A7 R2 versus anything Fuji has made, I don't think they're designed to do the same thing.
They're completely different machines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's why I think this is the second or third time we've come across this, Karen Minder, where someone has tried to talk about the A7 R2 and then whatever they went back to afterwards. Mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, whatever, dude. If you don't like a camera, don't use the camera. Use what you enjoy. I don't care what you're using. It's just a weird conversation to me.
Well, you know, photography is interesting because it combines art and technology. It's like at extreme ends, right? And so what happens is you have pure artists and then you have camera people. Mm-hmm. And camera people are proud about what their camera can do technically. The artists are proud of what they are doing creatively. And so that conversation about, well, this camera's better than that camera, that's all camera people stuff. And then when you get down, really, really get down to the nitty gritty, then it's really just about measure baiting and being like, well, it's a third of a stop difference and blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. And no one cares, man. It's like, no one cares. Like, I have never got any, and I shoot Micro Four Thirds, and I've never got any pushback from any clients on any assignment with Micro Four Thirds. Not once. And I'm shooting some pretty sizable stuff. Never. And when I shot full frame, I never had any pushback with that either. You know,
I think it's a made up fear that when people have to be shooting with a certain amount of, with a certain camera in order for them to get like a certain job or for them to like impress clients. It's not real.
I hear all the time when people just set up lights or extra lights in like a setting for the client.
Yeah.
It looks more fancy for the client. And
some clients, that's extra lights. When they're paying hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for a setup and you have to like have catering and multiple people there, the more big of an quote-unquote experience you can make it for certain clients, the more you can rationalize charging what they're charging and they're more comfortable with it.
Like there's a BTS crew there and taking an interview.
Well, all that stuff.
Well, it's always good to have BTS for everybody, and it's always good to have proper food on set.
This is true. Being fed is important.
You got to make sure everyone's taken care of, and you got to have water. And you know, it doesn't have to be like I've been on shoots where there's like you know, well these people are going to have their own RV with their own chef, and they're going to have lobster, and everybody else gets sandwiches. You know, I've experienced that. I'm just like, you know, well, fine. If that's what they want, that's fine. But as far as like what gear to shoot with and the lights and all that, I've never done anything funky. I'm like, look, this is you're hiring me for the end result. This is how I make the end result. If that don't work for you, then hire somebody else. Straight up. I've done dog and pony shows earlier in my career, and that gets you nowhere except for doing more dog and pony shows. But I got into photography not to like, I didn't get in because I'm like, well, I can make a ton of money. I got in because I wanted to be creative all the time and be in control of my own future. So I guess it's different for everybody, but I know like out in LA where who's in LA? Cameron, you're not in LA, are you?
Nope, I'm in the Bay Area.
We're both in San Francisco, but I've worked extensively in Los Angeles.
Okay,
so I kind of know the feeling.
That is, the whole city's a dog and pony show.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is. Why do you think we live here?
I like LA, I do, but it's like the whole thing's a dog and pony show. So, and then the whole thing about the fears, you know, art is a fear-based business. It's a fear-based business because when you go in a gallery and you see this red dot painted on a canvas and it's selling for a ton of money, I'm totally making this up, but and then you read like the description and it's like a bunch of bullshit. You're like, what is this? I've had this The red dot represents the fanciful delight that I feel when I'm walking on the beach in this under this whatever. It is like all this crap. Then it's like that kind of perpetuates the whole fear. Like these photographers are like, well, you got to have this certain amount of BS with your work, and part of that is the gear. I got to have a certain type of gear. I got to have a certain kind of tripod. And you really don't. I don't think. No. Maybe if anything, maybe a little more with retail-based photography, like weddings and stuff. Maybe. But that just boils down to education.
Yeah, I think as long as they like your work. I've never had an issue with anyone like that, where they're like, well, do you have to use this or do you use that? No. Well, mostly some people will ask me medium format or do you use a... Just mostly that, if you shoot medium format. They'll know photography if they ask that. But back to what you were saying, Julio, about artist versus technician. I'm definitely artist because I know that I could save a lot more money and buy a more capable camera. But I just know that, or I've done it. I've shot with it. And there's a feeling there in the images that resonates with me. That when I shoot, like Jaren, when you talk about the GH4 being not so great at stills, and I completely agree with you. And a lot of that for me is comparing that I'm used to seeing what I get out of the type of color I get out of my Leicas versus what I'll get from a GH4 and what I can do with it. Like that's an example where I prefer like say a GH4 for video. It's fantastic for it because all my Leicas suck at video. I'm not really built for it, but they do it anyway. But it's not like that's kind of what it comes down to is I'm probably not the technician, even though I know a little bit about it, but I definitely, for me, it's the feel. Like, how does it feel? What I'm making, what I'm capturing, how does that feel, and how does that resonate? And how that for me, that's my truth. That's my work. Sure, that's what's important to me. But Jaren, what about you?
I mean, I don't know if I have anything else to say here, honestly.
All right, let's move on then. All right, so I want to talk about a little bit of. All right, so by the time people are going to hear this, Apple's already announced what's coming out, like the iPhone 6S and probably 6S Plus and probably iPad Pro. And so the reason why I put this in here is more of just we are either going to make huge asses of ourselves right now or we'll be completely right and it will be amazing. So we're just going to quickly speculate. So the big news is that the iPhone will move from an 8-megapixel camera on the back to a 12-megapixel camera on the back that does 4K. So now imagine, the announcement's already been made, we can now shoot 4K on your iPhone, edit it, and be able to upload it. Does that change anything? How's that? Like,
no.
Okay.
I don't think it'll change anything for most people. You can do it right now with the iPhone 6 or 6 Plus, you can do 4K.
With the WYSIWYG app?
No, UltraCam 6 Plus will do it. You know, but the thing is like we have to, all this technology is amazing, but we got to think about where's the point of consumption for the media?
Exactly.
Okay. It's Instagram. That's my thing with it. It's Instagram. It's on a phone. And when I give my talks and my workshops, I kind of have a come to Jesus with the audience. I'm like, I don't care how hard you work on your images and you think you're just, you know, you think it's going to be so awesome that you're just going to change your name to Zeus because you're a god. And then at the end of the day, it ends up on Instagram and somebody's looking at your photos that you worked your ass off in line at Starbucks. And if you're lucky, they're going to hit the like button. And if you're really lucky, you get an emoji. You know, and that's where our work lives. So do you need 4K for Instagram? Not really.
No.
Nope.
Well, what about the whole, I don't know, I'm kind of shocked that you're going to get 12 megapixels in your camera. I know we just got done talking about specs.
I got 16 with this Galaxy Note.
Yeah, and I was just shooting 18 megapixel full frame, I don't know, like a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And I kind of don't want more megapixels. I mean, we talk back to the Canon 250 megapixel sensor.
I don't want more megapixels. I want better megapixels.
There you go.
Hey, you want better low light?
Word up.
No. I don't care about anything other than if I take a picture in perfect light, which I can do like on any of these cell phones, and I can zoom in on it and I'm looking at it and the textures are muddy. It's just like, it's not quite there.
Yeah.
That's where I would rather them focus their efforts than on making the pictures bigger. This is, again, I'll harken back to my statement about Canon earlier. I don't want your 50 megapixel camera. I want your 30 megapixel camera to have clean, beautiful, sharp, crisp, you know, nice flowing transitions between shadows and highlights. That's what I'm looking for. Quality, not size. And Julio's over there nodding his head like, yeah, this guy gets it.
Yeah, of course.
Right, this guy does get it.
You know, 16 megapixels on one of these camera phones. The CM1 I have is 20 megapixel, but that's a 1-inch sensor.
Yeah, the Panasonic CM1 cell phone.
That's a whole new world, man. That's a whole new world. I would take a larger sensor in a smartphone with less megapixels over 16 megapixels or whatever the heck it's going to be. You know?
Yeah, on like this little tiny little sensor.
That right. I mean, why didn't everybody stop what they were doing and buy the Windows phone by Nokia with 40 megapixels? You know, because
which one was that one?
Because it's a Windows phone.
Exactly. It's not about, you know, with phones, it's right. Definitely a choice about the experience of the device as opposed to, well, it's got all these specs. Because look at Apple. Apple's specs kind of suck for the most part.
Yeah, they do.
You know, but it's the experience and, of course, clever marketing that gets it sold.
They have to put in 3 or 4 wow-ish features per new phone.
Mm-hmm. So, this is one of them.
They'll market the heck out of them, and everyone will buy it.
Jaren, it's been 4 years or four devices that have been stuck to 8 megapixels. So this is why kind of a bigger news where this is going to be 12. But what I'm actually more excited about is the speculated iPad Pro. Specifically because, and this is in the show notes, because of this app, AstroPad, which has been out for a while. And the great thing about AstroPad, it connects to Lightroom. It's actually really fast in terms of its, even though it's a wireless connection, or is it a wired connection?
It's both. It can be wired or
they call it Liquid, right, Jaren?
I didn't hear the word for it, but I watched and looked at their stuff.
Yeah, instead of calling it AirPlay, they call it Liquid, and they talk about how many like nanoseconds or milliseconds that that there's a delay in between. Basically, if you're in Lightroom or Photoshop, you see the image on your iPad as well as on your laptop screen or computer screen, and you're able to do your little adjustments, your little adjustment brush here or there. And I mean, I use a Wacom tablet. This in my hand right now is the pen. This is my mouse for my whole computer. And this excites me a lot because the iPad Pro being kind of it's bigger than the new MacBook that just came out, which I think is a 12-inch screen. This is a 12.9-inch screen. The iPad Pro, and it's bigger than that, and I'm like, this is awesome. I can put my finger on it, and I can like, I'm gonna really wipe away those pimples with my finger, just like that, with the AstroPad. So I'm very excited about that. You guys,
You know what?
You guys are loving me today.
I have an iPad Pro. It's called the Surface Pro 3.
I also have a Surface Pro 3, and I also have an iPad, and I use both about the same amount.
Yeah,
and that for different things, like whatever. I usually am watching movies on the iPad, honestly. And if I'm not doing that, I'm streaming my video from my GH4, and my client is holding it so they can actually see what I'm shooting. So that's what I'd use my iPad for primarily. And I don't edit with it, and I don't need to, but I can see the benefit to people who are excited about it doing stuff like you're describing. Personally, like, I hardly need the iPad as it is right now. It's awesome when I do have it, but I don't crave it.
And then let's think about how awful styluses are on the iPad. They suck. I mean, I've had two of them. I had the Adonit Pro, blah blah blah.
Is that the one with the clear?
Yeah, it was like a C Note, right? So it was like $100. It was horrible. I returned that. And then I have the 53 by Paper. And I think that's like writing with, I might as well use my finger. It's so big.
Yeah. It seems iPad is designed for finger anyway.
Right. And exactly. And then, you know, I think it'll be cool in a pinch. I think that app could be really cool in a pinch, but it'll certainly not replace a Wacom tablet.
No.
And like I said, I got a Surface Pro 3 and, you know, I have never been a Windows person, but when I got it from Adobe Max last year, trying to figure out how to navigate Windows again, it took me maybe like a day. But then the thing is, most of my time, I'm in Creative Cloud apps. So Photoshop. Mm-hmm. And that's where Apple's got to be careful because they're basically abandoning their professionals in the creative community. So if I'm using Google apps for email and whatnot, which I am, and say I'm using
Same here.
Microsoft Office, and then I'm also using Creative Cloud, those are system independent. So mm-hmm. Apple's got to do something badass, and it's got to be more than hardware, because whatever's going to be inside the iPad Pro hardware-wise will have probably already been in some sort of Android tablet for like the last 2 years, you know.
And the Surface hasn't, we were talking about the pen experience.
And it's
the
amazing.
The pen experience on the Surface is really good. I wish that the pen was more customizable. I think mm-hmm. I wrote that in my review. But the actual like using it and the experience of like, you can actually rest your hand on the screen and it doesn't confuse itself. It knows that you're using the pen. It's cool. It's a really good experience. I like actually the Surface Pro 3 pen more than I like using a Wacom tablet.
Yeah, me
I
too.
I hate using a Wacom tablet.
And Windows 10 is good, I gotta say.
I haven't tried it yet. I should install 10 on my Surface, see what that's like.
You know,
have either of you used your tablets for retouching or anything like that specifically?
I don't really retouch
photo
anymore.
Processing?
I stopped retouching.
I'd used it a little bit just to see what it was like, and then I went back to my computer. Okay. My main computer.
Any of you guys tether with your devices? Or even wirelessly?
Not really. Does by tether, do you mean what my image app from Panasonic that I hand to my
clients?
Yeah,
that could work. Yeah.
That's technically a tether.
Yeah, that's tether. Yeah.
That I use. I do that.
That is such a handy app, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm looking forward to as well, because I do shoot tethered for still photos, and being able to just, instead of using a laptop, if I can just use an iPad, so I can just be anywhere and shoot kind of wirelessly tethered.
It's got to have USB then. If it doesn't have USB, it's got to have Thunderbolt. It's got to have one or both.
I hear right? It's not going to have Thunderbolt.
More than hardware, what's going to make it pro? They got to have some specialty apps that you can only get on the iPad Pro.
Run full iOS on it or something like that.
Yeah, we'll see.
No full, I think it's just going to be the same thing but bigger, and that's all I want, because I think there's plenty of apps already out there, and then you could be able to run at two apps at the same time on the screen is going to be... I'm excited about that. They already announced that. That's
like the Surface Pro 3 has been doing.
I guess like the Surface Pro 3.
And a 2.
Yeah.
But you know, I have no idea of where to get a Surface Pro 2, nor do I want to. I guess I am kind of locked in.
Well, the Surface Pro 4 will be announced here soon. I mean, they're going to they're going to announce something, and I think it's going to have to be badass. But the thing is, like, I got an iPad Air. I hardly touch it. There's a couple specific apps I like to use, like Replay for video, for doing sizzle reels and stuff. But you know, otherwise, it just kind of hangs out.
By the way, how do you get your footage into Replay?
I use the card connector kit, or I wait forever and a day and go through Dropbox.
It's good to know.
That's the only way. And that's the thing. So it's got to have hardware, but it's got to have the apps. It's got to have apps that you can really benefit from having a larger iPad. Otherwise, if it's
you AirDrop? Can you use
I think
you
can. That's like Mac to iOS or iOS to iOS. Yes, you can.
Mm-hmm. But you're still going over Wi-Fi and video transmission over Wi-Fi.
Do you ever go, Julia, from GH4 directly to your iPad Pro for video, or like, you know, when you talk about getting footage into Replay? I was hoping you were going to talk about that.
I don't necessarily Wi-Fi video unless it's. I mean, you can't with 4K. I'll do 4K photos to quickly send to a client so they can give me approval if I'm shooting somewhere remote. Or I'll do 1080p and I'll Wi-Fi that. But that takes a while just because, you know, you're limited to what you can transfer over Wi-Fi.
This is true. Okay. Guys, moving on. I want your opinions of what's the difference between a good photographer and a great photographer. What makes a good photographer and what makes a great photographer? Julio, Facebook likes. All right, good. No, got it.
Definitely Facebook likes.
All right, show's over. I'll see you.
No. What about the amount of emojis you receive in your comments?
That as well.
Right? Really important.
I think it's kind of funny, but I think in a way it's kind of true in today's world of photography. But I guess, you know, we'd have to decide, okay, are we judging photographers based on the content of the photo versus based on the technical aspects of the photo, right? So again, back to creativity versus technical, because there's a lot of photographers that are so good with their technical stuff. But like, I look at their images and I'm like, man, this is like banana and white bread and oatmeal blended together into mush. You know, where I see like some young photographers just get like an iPhone and they make these images. I'm like, damn, that's just the content is phenomenal. Like, they got into these remote areas to shoot whatever. technically the images are not that good. They're grainy and, you know, whatever, but the content's good. So I guess for me, I judge the photos based on the content versus the, you know, how clean and perfect it is.
It's good to know. Jaron, your 2 cents.
For me, it's, I'm going to go to Peter Hurley's thing, like 90% therapist, 10% photographer. I think the best photos and what makes a photographer really great is when they are able to have an interaction with what they're shooting, and that comes through in their photos. So like that kind of goes along with what Julia was just saying. Like it's kind of pretty obvious when someone has a firm grasp on what a camera can do, but they're not able to turn that into something pretty. And it's because I think they don't fully understand why or what they're shooting and attempting to capture, and trying to capture that thing in its emotion, in its whatever it is. And it can be a picture of a road and it can be a person, but you have to understand what you're shooting in order to capture it well and create something beautiful from it. And in a way it's teachable, and but at a certain point it's not. Someone has to actually like come across it themselves and really get it,
yeah,
or have just the artistic ability that is, you can't teach, unfortunately, in my opinion. But you can get someone on the right path, so where their brain starts working in a way for them to discover it for themselves.
That's good.
And a lot of it has to do with personal taste. I mean, a lot of people are still into hyper retouched images. And for me, that kind of fell off in 2007, end of 2007. I kind of stepped away from that. But, you know, it really depends on its personal taste. I mean, if I show my work to somebody and they're like, you're a great photographer and they're in charge of hiring me, then I agree with them.
Of course.
And, you know, that's kind of where I guess it boils down. But I think personal taste has a lot to do with it. Just like I'm not going to go, like personally, I'm not going to go to a store and look for a t-shirt that's got like a jewel encrusted cross on the back and some flourishes all over it.
What, you don't like Affliction brand clothing?
Some people do. I just would not go glitz up, you know, and get bedazzle my phone or something like that. And those people that are into that are probably not into the kind of work that I do.
Right.
You know,
the reason why I ask this is because our own Billy Murray, not to be confused with Hollywood's Bill Murray, he asked Michael Miller, who is a Los Angeles based photographer, about what it takes to go from good to great. And his explanation is anyone can take a great photo, but what makes a great photographer is someone who can replicate that great photo over and over again. They say it's someone that that masters 10,000 hours of doing something. But in my opinion, you never master anything. I'm learning today and I try to remain teachable on a daily basis. For one, I want to learn new stuff and I definitely don't think I know it all or remotely even close to it. And remaining teachable is what continues to make photography fun. Even after 30 years of shooting, there's always something new to find and discover. End quote. And so I ask you guys, advice for our listeners out there, how can they get from good to great?
Well, I think, and again, it depends on if they're, you know, they should try to fulfill the images that really speak to them. Mm-hmm. And they need to find out what those images are. I typically tell my students to create a vision file, which is as you're going through magazines, and you can do this with Pinterest or whatever. I tear out pages that just something about it catches my eye, and I put it in a folder, and I come back to it about every 3 months, and I take out all those images out, and I lay them on the ground, and I get a Sharpie, and I start writing on top of those pages. I like this, the way the light falls off in the shadows. And this image, I like that it's grainy. And in this one, I like that it's black and white. And so, and then at the end of this exercise, I try to see if there's some sort of commonality within these images. And then I find that commonality. Then I see, okay, how does this fit into my current body of work? And then if I say, okay, I want to make my body work, I want to bring in that type of imagery into my body work, then I'm going to go out and make self assignments, passion projects, some people call them, and create work that fits into those missing areas. And I think that's an exercise that everybody should do to go from good to great.
For me, it's get off the hamster wheel of telling yourself that if I only get this one more thing. I say this like all the time.
Then I'm going to do this.
It's like my same thing. It's like my spiel. But like, I think it's nice and good to emulate, other photographers that you want to be like, mm-hmm. but you have to stop at a certain point and decide what Julia said. What do you want to capture? What makes you go? And I think that this also leads back before, like, what makes a good image and how come somebody's photo isn't any good is because it lacks soul and emotion and the love of the person taking the image, who's actually thought of something, saw something, and made it happen. And all of that is really, really, like, it's tangible through these images that this is, like, this means something to this photographer, and they captured it in this manner because of that. So, like, stop. And a lot of people will also overthink the heck out of stuff. And that's what's happened when you overlight someone, too. It's just like, maybe if I just add three more, it'll have that look of that guy on the cover of that magazine. It's just like, stop thinking and just start shooting. And you'll be really happy with what you get. And I think this actually bleeds really well into this other topic we were going to talk about, which is like why you should do personal projects always and make time for them. Mm-hmm. Like Giulio just said that he'll do it just because you want to see how the idea came through and where it fits into what you're doing. That's what you mm-hmm. said, right? Something along those lines.
Yep.
Like that's a perfect reason why you should always be doing personal projects is like, where are you going as an artist evolving your style? And is your style evolving? And does it even have to? Like, where are you right now as a photographer and why? So, like, and doing paid work is necessary, but through paid work, you don't discover these things about yourself grow as an artist.
Yeah. Real quick, going back to, I guess, the last story before we talk about how you should always make time for your personal work is I love what you guys are giving for advice. It's very high level. I'm going to try and keep it a little bit more lower level, at least. I guess lower level, but shoot more. Just shoot more.
Stay off of forums.
Yeah, well,
that's like a rule all the time.
Yeah,
yeah. Just shoot more, and just keep downloading and processing those images, and that's like your little circle of life right there. And then you go out and you shoot more, and you'll learn every time you complete that cycle of shooting, downloading, editing, post processing your pictures, and then you kind of see your mistakes right then and there, and that will also close down your creative gap. Because you probably have really good taste, but you're not able to achieve those pictures where you feel like, oh, I see what I wanted, but I didn't execute it well. And then the next time you go out and you shoot, that gap is going to get a little bit smaller and a little bit smaller, a little bit smaller. And until you can consistently be able to pull off what's in your head as a shot.
And if you don't mind me adding to what you said, because you want to create with intent and not casually be creative. Mm-hmm. So when people, you know, I love doing photo walks, and that's the one thing I tell people in a photo walk is make up your mind now before you even start to walk, what five final images are you going to have at the end of the day? You know, go out and create with intent. Don't just kind of randomly casually create, because then you're not exercising your right brain. You may be exercising your left brain for the technical stuff. But if you're like, well, I'm just going to go out for a walk and get what I get, then you get what you get. There's no creative growth. There's like, you will stumble onto things and occasionally have these creative breakthroughs, but you're not going to really grow as an artist. So if you go out and you say, okay, I'm going to go out for a walk and I'm going to take five photos at the end of my walk, I want to have five finished images of my feet on different textures or something to that effect. Or I'm going to get creative with garbage I find on the ground and go do cool macros or something. You're going out with the intent to be creative.
To having a direction,
I'm yes. sure. Yes. Yeah.
Translate a little. Yeah. Having a direction is important. Yes. Intent.
Yeah. It makes a big difference. Otherwise, you know, you're just kind of stabbing in the dark.
Which is, I think, the bigger kind of, and that's having like a good direction on day of. But now we're going to go to the next story, which is why you should always make time for your own personal projects. And this is basically saying having a bigger direction or a bigger story direction that you come up with yourself and that you make time to do it. And a lot of professionals like Joey L., Chase Jarvis, like they preach this, they talk about this where that not only, yeah, you do your commercial work, you get paid for that, but in order to like push your own boundaries and experiment and be able to do new things, you have to be able to make and do personal work.
Mm-hmm.
Jaren, you want to talk about it?
Not in my head.
Not in your head. All right, he's agreeing. So it's basically you got to like set aside the time, stick to that time, and find the right amount of time. It's a balance, right? Because you still got to work, still got to put food on your table. Because this personal work, not gonna feed you right away. It'll feed your soul, right? Soul gets fed. Some chicken soup for that. And realize the workflow benefits as well as the creative ones for doing something like this, and start small, and then slowly expand your comfort zone, and then remind yourself why it is that you picked up a camera, or a paintbrush, or a pen.
Mm-hmm.
You want to say anything else about this?
I'm happy to. I think people need to do self assignments, tests often, especially professionals. It's so easy to get caught into the trap of, hey, now I'm making money and I got my business set up and my business is to shoot business portraits or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. And then you get your lighting down and you know what lens you like and how you like to pose a person and all that. And that becomes a nice, healthy business. But then you're not developing your creative soul. And you can often find yourself, okay, well, cool, now I'm making money, but I'm completely not satisfied with photography. You know, now it just becomes a boring business. And it's easy to get into that trap. When I first started shooting as an amateur, I was just doing it for the love of it. And then that's one of the reasons why I got into shooting full time. And then I ended up getting all this work eventually, which was great. But then my creativity started to hurt. So I always make time for creative work. I just finished a project recently that I put up on my YouTube page where I wanted to experiment with growth and like birth and death and all that. So how can I communicate this through light? And then built a team together and I got talent and I went on and shot this. And then those images, those test images, I'll often put online and I'll share them and potential clients will see those. And quite often they're like, I want to hire you to make something that looks like that. And you're like, oh, cool. That was my self-assignment, you know.
I have that experience a lot, honestly. Like the stuff that gets me hired is the stuff that I did for myself.
Always, because people can see the passion and the fire and the love in that.
And they want that passion, but with their brand in there.
Exactly. That's exactly right, because that is getting eyes on their product. I mean, what I tell people is that there's like the spectrum of clients. On one side, you have pure art. These are like my buddies calling me up and like, can we shoot a music video? We got no money, but we'll buy you a burrito and a six pack or something. I'm like, cool, let's go do that. On the other end, you got pure trash for cash. It's a type of shoot that it's like lava in your brain, but you know what? It'll pay really well. So you can do more of the stuff, creative stuff with your friends again. And the goal for me is to find the stuff that's somewhere in the middle that is allowing me to be creative, but is also bringing in a decent amount of money without feeling like at the end of the day, I'm not going to want to show any of this commercial work to anybody, you know? So, and that's where the self assignments come in. Cause it's easy to say, well, I can shoot that. And as opposed to actually creating it and then showing it to somebody and say, hey, I made this.
Yeah. I like that. So let's go. Next one is now four things or four habits of thriving artists. And I'm sure all of us do this here. So, this was posted on the Creative Live blog and, essentially it's just, you know, all of us here, Julio, Jaren, God, a lot of J's. get a little distracted. You guys' names, I almost mix you up. None of you guys had to wake up today today's Labor Day, sorry. On a Tuesday, you don't have to wake up and go into an office. Is this correct?
Yes.
Correct.
Now, but this also means you must have also a lot of discipline and a lot of habits that you've grown to make sure that you don't just, you know, sit in your pajamas all day and play video games and eat popcorn.
Well, I do that on occasion.
I know, Jaren, I'm not trying to bust you out, boy.
You know,
I mean, I totally do that.
But we have to have independent creative habits. So like these are the four habits that they're mentioning here. Number one is they make friends. Are we friends? Please don't burn me.
Yes.
Julio's nodding, but nodding doesn't work for a podcast, bro.
I don't know. Okay. Maybe. Yeah, we're friends. You gotta have human contact. Otherwise, you go nuts.
And I met all of you guys through this industry, through the photography video industry. I think, Jaren, I met you first at a WPPI event. We were not in a professional setting. We were at, I just saw you, but I didn't get to meet you then, which was at, was it Bleacher's Madhouse? Something in the MGM Grand.
Beecher's Madhouse. That was a crazy night.
Because that is, it was a crazy night. And that's how we met, or at least we got to, I knew you were there. And then Julio, I met you, I want to say WPPI as well.
I think so.
Yeah. And so WPPI, it's a trade show. So we got another trade show coming up, Photo Plus Expo. It's a great place to make friends. Like Jaren makes friends and then brings them on and hires them to work on our website too, like Mikhail.
She's my wedding photographer now, actually.
Oh, look at that. Yeah, see? Make friends, get jobs, get work. Another second habit they mention is that everyone takes notes.
Oh, yeah.
Jaren, do you take notes?
I should take more notes.
You should take
more.
That's okay.
See, the way my brain works, I process things and I store stuff up there, but I'm starting to get more, as I get older, it's been harder and harder for me to remember everything. So I should take more notes. I have a whiteboard actually that I bought specifically to take notes on, and there are notes on it right now. But I didn't write them.
Oh, you didn't write them. Okay. Someone else did. Well,
yes, telling me things I need to do.
Whether you get a Moleskine or a notepad or Evernote, I know Jeremy Cowart, just like, I think he, if you look back on his blog or his website where he has like this free PDF, I think, about how he uses Evernote more effectively. That's great. So basically, yes, take notes, collect all your thoughts and all your ramblings somewhere so that you can make something cohesive and maybe make a personal project out of it later. That's why. Third habit, planning ahead. Do you guys plan ahead?
It helps, yeah.
I can't function if I can't plan ahead. Like I'm trying to work, like tomorrow, I have a shoot tomorrow morning at sunrise and I still don't know all the details and it's driving me insane. So there you go. It's killing me.
It's so important. Do you guys plan ahead?
Go ahead.
It's so important to plan ahead because in any kind of shoot or anything you do as an entrepreneur, there's always curveballs that come your way. So whether you're planned or not. So if you're planned, if you got a plan and you're organized and you got a curveball, you're much more equipped to deal with it in a way that you could actually use that curveball to your advantage. But if you're just like living in chaos and then you get a curveball, then it's just like your world comes apart pretty quick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just going to say having a backup plan, which is exactly what you said, Julio, having a backup plan and a backup to that backup plan. And this is, I guess, why we also bring backup gear as well to anything that we do that's, say, getting paid or anything. But yeah, having multiple plans is always helpful. And then final habit, being okay with being uncomfortable.
Yeah, for sure.
So putting yourself in situations where like, I've not really done this before, but I have a plan, I got a backup plan, but I'm going to go for it. That's kind of the mentality that I have when I do things like, no, things will be okay. I'm going to go for it. And yeah, okay, there's a curveball here. All right. I'm like Keanu Reeves in a Matrix dodging bullets while like situations or problems are happening around me. And that's what you got to be. And being comfortable with being uncomfortable. I know it sounds really oxymoronic, but that's kind of the gist of it. Like you can't get frazzled too quickly and can't shut down. You have to think on your feet. I feel like most of the things we do are just we're problem solvers.
Oh, for sure. You're problem solvers with light and lens.
Also people skills.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That helps a lot. Helps me a lot. Anything else, Jaren, you want to add?
You mentioned earlier the whole like discipline thing.
Yes.
I think the reason I don't function well in an office situation is that I can't, and I don't think any human actually can, function well for the solid 8 hours, 5 days a week. I don't think humans can do that. And I think that's why like there's been studies that show like a lot of companies are fine with most people getting 2 hours of like real work done in a standard workday in an office situation. I get more, I probably get in about 5 a day here, unless I'm working on a project that's really got me engulfed and I could end up losing track of time and I'll be sitting here for like probably about 8. That's when I forget to eat and drink and go to the bathroom, that sort of thing, because I'm working so hard on something. That hasn't happened in a while. I haven't had a project that's really enveloped me like that, but it's not healthy to do that. So when you say like, you got to make sure you don't sit in your underwear and play video games today, I will plan ahead. I will plan to not work. I'm not working Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday next week.
Yeah,
I'm
downtime.
Not doing it. I'm shutting off. I'm not turning on my computer. I'm not connecting to anything. I'm not going to check my emails. I will not be working because I need some time to be able to function properly. Because you can't flip on and off creativity like you can like a machine. So you need to be fully charged, at least in my opinion, in order to be able, when a client says, I need you to work this day to do these projects and make something pretty, I can't be burned out before I go into that. I need to be like super chill, need to have been sleeping well and doing something that I enjoyed for the days up to that. And then I get to on set and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm feeling this. I got the vision for this now, and I roll.
Yeah. So I'm super on the same side as you with sleep, because I cannot, like, I going to art school, I learned very quickly that if I didn't get enough sleep, I couldn't do anything. Julio?
Yeah, sleep is totally important. I mean, and the older you get, the more difficult it is to pull all-nighters. And, you know, there was one point in my life when I thought all-nighters would help get things done, but that is a long time ago. You know, I could, if I get good night's sleep, I can take what I would do in an all-nighter and get it done in about 45 minutes, you know, because I'm so focused. I think one of my, couple of my creative habits that I do on a regular basis when I wake up, I journal. And it's whatever's on my mind. Yeah. It's like a stream of consciousness kind of thing. And that's what I've been using my Surface Pro 3 for. I wake up in the morning, take that pen, and not with the intention to come back later and read it, you know, just to get it out of my head. And I don't even look at it again. Just, and that kind of clears my mind for the rest of the day. And then I don't look at any emails until around like 10 a.m. I just refuse. I'm like that's just time for me to write and to really just get the basis of my day, the foundation set. And another thing I've been doing that it works out really well for me is I make time to play. Mm-hmm. So if I'm on a...
Like video games in your underwear like I do?
Well, actually, when I'm on an
Thanks
airplane...
Thanks for the visual, Jane. Not going
to
get that out of my head.
I used to try to work on when I'm flying, but I don't anymore. Now I make sure to have some video games ready to go.
Yeah.
And I'll just play video games. And I'll allow myself that time to waste. So that, you know, so I'm not, because that way, otherwise I'm always thinking about work and what's the next shoot going to be like? Have I called this client? And when is this client going to pay me? And what am I going to be talking about at this event? And all these other things. So if I can just play a video game and have fun, you know, and know what it's like to have fun, and I can bring that element, that experience into my work and when I shoot and when I interact with people.
And I know everyone's curious about this now, Julio, because you mentioned it. Which video game are you playing?
I was playing, God, I don't know the name of it. It was like some, I don't even know what game it was. It was like some tunnel game. I couldn't even tell you. I get them and I just put them on the phone, take them off. But it's been a lot of fun.
Okay, good. Thank you for joining us, guys. Comments, questions, you can reach us on Twitter at RerapPodcast. You can find us at resourcemagonline.com. And also email us, rerap@resourcemagonline.com. And Julio, how do they get in contact with you? What's your Twitter?
You got to go to my name, Julio Shorio. If you can spell, you'll find me. And if you can't, you won't. It's as simple as that.
All right. He's available also at julioshorio.com. And if you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes, subscribe, send us some Twitter love, and share us with your friends and have them give us a listen. We really appreciate it. All right, he's at Jaren Schneider on Twitter. I'm at Karaminder on Twitter. And this has been Rerap Podcast, episode 29. You guys say goodbye. I'm saying goodbye.
Adios. Bye.